Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Today, we're joined for a special bonus episode with a legend in the JFK assassination research community, Mr. Robert Grodin. Mr. Grodin appeared on Good Night America with Geraldo Rivera, along with comedian Dick Gregory, and it was there that he showed a copy of the Zapruder film to the world for the first time. He also testified before the Rockefeller Commission and was a photo optics technician who served as a consultant to the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Robert Grodin is also an author, having written several excellent books on the assassination. We'll cover Grodin's JFK assassination research career, along with his take on the authenticity of the Zapruder film, among other topics, coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Hey, Robert, how you doing?
Very fine, thank you. How you doing, Matt?
Doing well, doing well. Thank you so much for joining the show. I've met you a couple of times, just in passing, super briefly, at conferences here and there. But this will be good to have a longer form conversation with you. I'm really looking forward to it.
Me too.
All right. Well, I guess the best way is to get started is just sort of, how did you get into photography? That's sort of your entry into this as an early expert, really a first generation expert, is on the photographic side of things. So could you just kind of talk about how you got into that, which then led to your photography related things in the JFK case?
Well, I've always been fascinated by photography, even as a kid. I set up a little dark room and in the house, and just grew from there. And the interest in photography was one of a technical terms, just processes and how it worked and all. And then I got into the film industry, which was a bit more advanced. The film situation with the Kennedy assassination is quite unique. People are familiar now that I've released the Zapruder film with the film, but there are so many others. There's something like 14 or 15 of them in Dealey Plaza. None of them were made available by the government. I was just very, very lucky to be able to release them all. And it is the most photographed crime in history.
Yeah.
Both still photographs and films. And that's what fascinated me, because I'm more visually oriented, much more than words, even though I've written 8 books. The fact that people can look at the photographs, each photograph is worth 1,000 words. I've released 2,200 mm-hmm. pictures.
And to that end, I got to say, you're talking about how, look, it's not just the Zapruder film. You've got all these other films. And that's really kind of says a lot that the government didn't release those films. That's the kind of really important exhibits, one would think, for the Warren Commission. But I just want to direct folks in the audience. There's a great episode of America's Untold Stories with that Robert was on, where he breaks down the films. You go film by film and break it down. I was watching that yesterday, and I found that to be really helpful. Not just the Zapruder film, but many of these films that we're talking about. So I thought that was really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about you're working. So your introduction to the case is you happen to be working in this photo lab. This is what I read online. You tell me if I got it wrong. The photo lab does a good job on the Woodstock film project. So then the photo lab gets the business from Life magazine to do the Zapruder film, and you happen to be working on it. Is that all correct?
That's very close to it. Yeah. All the home movies for Woodstock were 8mm, and to blow them up to 35mm, they needed someone who had the capability of doing it, and we were the only ones who did. So they came to us with the Zapruder film, and it was a challenge. They wanted to get the very best quality possible, and the best way to do it would be to go directly from 8mm to 35 without going through 16mm first, because every generation decreases the quality of the result.
And I'm not super well versed in film, so the value of going to 8mm or going to 35 from 8, is that just like making it a higher resolution? What's the point of doing that?
Yeah, higher resolution, less noise in between. Every time you go through an intermediate stage, you're adding noise, as it were, visual noise, to the result. And going directly from 8mm to 35mm was a way to do it. But the capabilities of, how can I explain this? We're using an optical printer. An optical printer has a light source, and then the light source goes through a projector, and then an intermediary lens, a second projector, if you're going to add special effects, which we didn't do, but then into a camera, all on a lathe bed. To do that, you blow it up. You have to wind it back, but the machine itself won't go that far. It wasn't built to do that much of a blow up. So what we had to do is we had to take the bellows off of the lens and turn the lights out in the room and just add exposure time to it. It was a rather involved situation, took some testing, but the results were fantastic. And anyone who buys one of the copies of the film that are now available commercially, you can see how great the situation turned out to be.
You've got did you get a copy of the film or the original film that you guys were from?
We got the original film, the camera original, which is actually zero on the copy numbers. The first negative from the original film would be stage one. Then the print from that would be stage two, and that's what I had.
Gotcha.
So we had the original and created the very best possible negatives.
All right, so it's what, 1967? Is that what year this is?
What?
69.
Okay, so it's 1969. You're working on the Zapruder film, and then you decide, I'm going to make a copy of this. Can you kind of walk me through that thought process and kind of what your plan was? Because that was a pivotal moment in American history when that happened.
My boss, Mo Weitzman, who has unfortunately since then passed away, made me a copy of the film. He let me have the original and let me work on working on the film itself. I created a situation which has become known as Grodin scoping, which is to take and isolate parts of the original film and blow it up so that the mind isn't taken away from what you're looking at, and you can focus on a stabilized version of the film. I did it with the president. I did it with Mrs. Kennedy. I did it with the drivers, the driver and the Secret Service guard, Governor Connally, Mrs. Connally, witnesses in the background. I just eliminated everything around them and restabilized the film. Zapruder was dizzy. He was very dizzy. And the film is not very stable. The president's all over the place. So what I did is I shoot one frame at a time and then reposition horizontally and vertically and stabilize it that way. And then on top of that, what I did is I did copies of it in slow motion, whereby I did use a process called step framing, where I doubled the frame. I would shoot each frame twice. So when it projects back, it projects slower. The original film is shot at 18.3 frames per second. Professional equipment all runs at 24 frames, which is the sound speed. So playing back an 18 frame film at 24 frames, it goes by way too fast. The mind can't comprehend what you're seeing. So I slowed it down that way too. I did lots of things like this with the film to make it as important as far as evidence goes as possible.
So the copy that you ended up taking public is not one that you made specifically for that purpose. It was a copy that you were using and doing your work on the project, and then you already had it, basically.
Here's the situation. The copy that most people saw was on Good Night America. I brought them a straight copy, which had the problem of going by too fast because of the problem I just mentioned. So I offered to make them a stretch frame copy. They were just in too much of a hurry, and they slowed it down using something called a slow-mo disc. And a slow-mo disc is a situation whereby it slows it down mechanically, but it degrades the quality of the picture massively. So the copy that I showed on Good Night America was, in fact, the clearest copy that was ever seen by the public. But my copies, which I made that from, were much clearer. And it would have been much clearer if, in fact, they'd have waited and let me do the right thing for them and slow it down. I had various choices there. They were in a hurry. They realized how important it was. So they just wanted to get it done. We did it.
So what led you to take it public? I mean, I'm sure you expected some pushback. I guess what led to the whole Geraldo thing? I know there was one before that in California, but what got that process started? Because you got the copy, and somehow you go from having it to showing it to the whole world, and then that sets dominoes off that get us to where we are today.
I had released the film at a conference in Boston, and it was picked up as a news story, and it ran around the country. And
When was
Geraldo,
that? What year? Sorry to interrupt you. What year?
this particular one was 1975,
Got it.
February 75. Dick Gregory, the social activist, came to the conference, and he saw me and saw the film. And he came up to me afterwards, introduced himself. I said, "You don't have to tell me who you are, I know." He said, "Well, you got to do more with this than just show it at this one conference." I said, "What do you suggest?" So we went and we talked about it, and we decided he was going to hold a press conference in Chicago and had me there with him to show the film and show more detail about what was going on with this. And then he had already had an appointment to testify before the Rockefeller Commission. And he invited me to get along with that too. And I did. And while I was testifying to the Rockefeller Commission, we got a call from Geraldo's office. And he wanted to know if I would show the film on for national showing for the first time. And I agreed, and I showed it to him. And while we were waiting to get the stuff done, they were starting to advertise it was going to be shown. And Life magazine, who owned the film, was very, very upset, and they threatened to sue if we showed it. And ABC's lawyers said, you can't show it. So Geraldo, back in those days, had a great deal of credibility and cared. And he said, if you don't show it, get yourself a new boy. I'm going to quit. And they decided it was worth it to take the chance. We showed it, and the next day, the next morning after it showed, we got a one-time permission to license the film for one-time music. And they never sued, thank goodness. But Dick Rivers said that he would cover the costs of legally if it came to that, but it never did.
So aside from so that's interesting that's a classic move in the legal world of someone who has given up their rights and then they retroactively bless it so they don't waive them in the future. That's kind of what they did there, it sounds like. But aside from Life magazine doing their legal posturing, which makes sense, they did own the film rights. I mean, there's a little thing called fair use, by the way, Life magazine, that probably would have been a pretty good defense for you. But aside from that, were there any governmental or otherwise scary individuals who tried to stop you from showing the films? Any incidents or not really?
Through the years, there have been quite a few. Back in December of 1983, our house was firebombed.
Peace.
And it was in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock in the morning, two Molotov cocktails. And I went to call the fire department to report the what was going on. And the phone had stopped working, strangely enough. And the people across the street saw the fire and heard the explosions, and they called the fire department. They got the fire out before there's any real damage done. And that was the first in the deal in Dealey Plaza, where I was set up. Over the years, I was attacked several times, once with a hunting knife, once with a guy throwing a chair, a wooden folding chair at me, and another with a large piece of wood. No, but one of the worst situations was when Homeland Security was called, and I was told that I was a terrorist.
Interesting. But there was nothing stopped nothing before you went forward on Geraldo with like the government trying to stop you.
Yeah, no,
Okay.
not at all. I guess everybody who was involved figured that life-threatening would be enough.
Right.
Life fortunately did not follow through on it and made the film available for the public to see. And after that, the case essentially got reopened all over again. Through the years, there have been a couple of issues that have really helped the case. The first was Jim Garrison in the Shaw trial in New Orleans. That was the first one that gave the interest to the public. The next was my showing the film publicly. That really, really did it. This is worth. There's 486 frames of the film. Each picture, each frame is worth 1,000 words. So that was quite good. The third was Oliver Stone's fabulous film, JFK. And then that created other public investigations and things of that nature and gained a lot of interest with people like me and individuals around the case. And the case essentially exists now. Because I was lucky enough to be able to release the film. I'm very, very proud of that fact. It made all the difference. But not just the Zapruder film. There are others as well. The Nix film, the Much More film, tons of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And from your story, I mean, obviously you're the one that had the film, you're the one who came forward initially, but Dick Gregory played a role in trying to amplify it, and Geraldo demonstrated a little bit of a moxie there by standing up to the network. So that's it's cool that you're telling that story.
He sure did. it was important that he did it. You know, why he did it was I think he realized that it would get him a lot of attention and help his audience. It was the first time in history that actually another show outrated The Tonight Show.
And that was in 1975?
Yes.
So 1975, that's the sort of the year of intelligence, right? That was the you got the church committee, you got the Pike committee, and then you had the Rockefeller Commission, which you spoke before. Can you unpack your experience before the Rockefeller Commission and kind of what you were talking to them about, how that went?
Well, they were not willing to accept the fact that the film showed that shots came, or at least one, the headshot came from another direction. And they fought me on that a lot. There were people connected with the Rockefeller Commission that had been involved with the Warren Commission first. So they were very defensive of what they had done. But the Zapruder film speaks for itself. First he's thrown forward, and then he's thrown backwards at a much greater rate of speed. This means that the fatal shot came from the front. And because of that, the whole issue became, you know, if you're shot from behind, as the Warren Commission said, you're not going to go backwards, you go forward. And since that didn't happen, the issue became very clear. And it's still being debated to this day.
Yeah, and you just mentioned there were some folks involved with the Warren Commission. Well, specifically, David Bellin was on the Rockefeller Commission. And it was established by Gerald Ford, who obviously was a Warren Commissioner. And by the way, you got Lyman Lemnitzer, General Lemnitzer, on the commission. And then a guy by the name of Ronald Reagan as well. So that's pretty interesting. So they weren't really hearing it. Gotcha. But it is interesting that all of that stuff in 1975, you know, that was going on investigation wise, plus you showing this Zapruder film, that's a powerful cocktail there of media, I would say. Let's talk about the HSCA. So that's kind of the next domino that fell after that a few years later. How did you get involved with the HSCA? I guess how far along in the process? Because I know, you know, at first they were really taking it seriously with Tannenbaum as a deputy counsel. And then, you know, they basically told him that he couldn't pursue what he wanted to pursue, and they were not going to support him. And that's when Sprague left and he left. Did you come in before that or did you come in after that? And what was your experience like?
I had come in before that. Congressman Thomas Downing of Virginia was in charge of the whole shebang. And he hired me as the first person that was hired. And I did the very first interviews with a fellow named Billy Lovelady, who was a man standing in the doorway of the depository during the shooting.
No, that's Oswald. Just kidding. I'm kidding. Sorry.
that's an important thing with this. They flew me to Denver, where he was living at the time. He's now passed away too, but we interviewed him, and I showed him the pictures of him, thinking that it was Oswald in the doorway. He said, "No, that's me," he said. And his wife, who was sitting there, said, "That's Billy. There's no question about it." And he identified himself. She identified him. She brought out their family photo album, showed me wedding pictures, and you'd swear you're looking at Oswald. That's how much they looked like. When Oswald was arrested and killed and all that, he was 24. Billy Lovelady was over 30 at the time. But she explained to me, his wife explained to me, that about a week before the assassination, she had gone to the depository to talk to Billy and do some business, whatever. And she looked out across the room and said, "Billy, Billy." No response. As it turns out, it wasn't Billy at all. It was Oswald. Mm. And somebody looked alike. But the thing is, they identified Billy as being in the doorway. Buell Frazier, who had driven Oswald to work that morning, was standing in the doorway, and Oswald was there with him. So he was not the person who was in the photograph. The fellow in the photograph was wearing a different shirt. The shirt he was wearing is the one that Lovelady was wearing later that day in the police headquarters. But he said if Oswald had been the one standing next to him there where this guy was standing, he'd definitely know it. Yeah. And he said it wasn't him.
Did you say Frazier said that he was standing next to Oswald and on the first floor close to Lovelady, or am I misunderstanding that?
No, I misspoke that one. I'm sorry. Okay. He said the Lovelady was the one who was standing right next
to him. Oh, right. Frazier said Lovelady was standing next to him. Got it. Right. Okay.
Also, Lovelady appears in at least three other films at the same time, too.
Right. For sure. Do you, while we're talking about that concept, do you have thoughts on the Bart Camp's Prayer Man theory, that not Lovelady, but the guy next to Lovelady, that must be Oswald because everyone else is accounted for? Or are you familiar with that argument?
I disagree with it completely. Okay. The fellow who he's calling Prayer Man is holding up a camera. He's going like that. It looks like he's praying, but he's holding a camera. And it's a film that we have not yet seen after all these years. So anyway, if that wasn't Oswald, then it must be him. No, mm-hmm. It just worked out that way. But
we don't know. You don't know who that guy is, though, right?
We don't know who most of those people are.
Yeah,
Lovelady was unique. He was wearing this brown, orangey, plaidish shirt. Part of the problem we had with this is the FBI called Lovelady up and wanted him to come down to headquarters because they wanted to photograph him. He said, should I wear the shirt I was wearing that day? They said, nah, we just want your face. So they called him down and he was wearing a striped shirt. When the FBI released the photograph, they said, Lovelady wearing the shirt he was wearing that day, which it wasn't, and they knew it wasn't, but they said it. And people started saying, well, it's not him because he's not wearing the striped shirt. It must be Oswald. Well, it wasn't. And they knew it, too. They created a false issue. Hmm. Through the years, one of the things that has become an important part of my arguments on this is I was talking to a woman named Geraldine Reed, who worked on the second floor. When most of the workers had gone down to the street to watch the president go by, she didn't have seniority, and they left her behind in case the phones rang. About a minute before the actual shooting, Oswald walked into her office and asked for change of a dollar bill to use the Coca-Cola machine. And as she's counting out the change into his hands, the shots went on. Oswald had an airtight alibi right there. He was talking to her. And that's become a major part of my argument on all of this.
Is that the conversation you had with her, is that in any of your books?
Oh, yeah. It's in this one. It's in JFK Absolute Proof.
Okay. Hey, speaking of, look at this one right here.
Yeah.
There it is.
This one right here.
Hey, we got the same one. They're matching. I bet yours is an autograph, though, huh?
I know the guy who wrote it.
All right. All right. Well, hey, let's talk about a couple other HSCA just real quick. That's huge on Reed. I mean, if she's my recollection from like the official Warren Commission statement is that she says that she saw him walking through, but they maybe have massaged or changed that from what you just said, because it wasn't as clear as how you just laid it forward, what, you know, her official story statement is.
Well, she had told me much more detail. She said that when Oswald wanted the change, he said, nickels and dimes and quarters, I don't want pennies, no pennies. He was Lee Harvey Oswald. The Oswald, the the parts of his name, the parts of his background, his family life. Was extreme dyed-in-the-heart Southerner and wanted nothing to do with Abraham Lincoln. And somebody else whose name for the moment is, I can't think of who it was, she testified before the Rockefeller Commission, before the Warren Commission, and mentioned that fact that Oswald didn't want $5 bills because of Lincoln. Except for that mention of Geraldine Reed, there's not a single mention of her anywhere in the Warren Commission reports. They flew her to Washington, took her testimony, and never published a word of it.
She's referred to as, I think, Mrs. R.L. Reed, maybe, in the documents.
Robert Reed. And the thing is that there were two Mrs. Reeds, Dolores and Geraldine, and they confused one with the other. And they never mention, when they talk about Mrs. Robert Reed, they never mention her first name ever once. They've just confused the issue.
It's like, hey, it's a person. Maybe let her have a name. Anyway, all right. So I want to talk Macon Rally, and I want to talk Regis Blahut.
Planning a trip this year? Imagine how much richer your travel experience could be if you could speak the local language. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you go. Rosetta Stone also has lifetime memberships that give you access to all 25 languages so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. And best of all, Marina Oswald used Rosetta Stone to learn English when she came to the United States. Thanks, Rosetta Stone. Okay, that part's not true, but Rosetta Stone is awesome. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Solving JFK listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start improving your language skills right away. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. They found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern you can think of. Best of all, not only is every product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you can get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches the mood you're looking for. 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK.
Let's talk Macon Rally first, if we can. I talked about this with Tannenbaum as well. Because Macon Rally for Tannenbaum is one of sort of the main arguments he makes, in favor of a conspiracy. And what the document is, and we've gone in depth on the document itself. It's basically the Secret Service. I'm sorry, the head of the CIA, Macon, writing a letter to the head of Secret Service, James Rally, saying basically, "Hey, Oswald's our guy. He worked for us. You know." Talks about the Dallas action, which makes clear that there was, a conspiracy, etc. It's basically the smoking gun document that definitively proves everything. It's just the only problem is the people, both the critics and a lot of folks. So when I say the critics, I mean the official story defenders, of course, but then also a lot of folks who are on the critical side who think there was a conspiracy also dismissed the Macon Rally document. And the reasons they dismiss it, there's two reasons. One is it doesn't have a RIF number, which, as I now know, that is meaningless. That is not a good reason to dismiss it, because the National Archives, as my friend Andrew Eiler has done work, and Jeff Crudell, Paul Blow as well, Mark Adamczyk knows about this too. But long story short, there's a way that these documents could have gotten into the National Archives outside of the JFK Records Act, which would mean there would be no RIF number. So I have no problem with that. The only other argument people make is, well, some of like the metadata or like the date number, the file number is not consistent with a CIA file number or whatever. And I'm just not hip to that. But for me, it's like, okay, well, what's the provenance of this document? How did we get it? Where did it come from? And is that something you can kind of share with us, your thoughts on the validity of the McCone Rowley document and anything you may know about that?
Yeah. The document itself was a memo between Rowley and the Warren Commission. They wanted to know is it true that Oswald worked for you? He said, and it was not a formal situation. It was not sent through channels. It was not a document by definition, but it was in fact written. And the response was, as a matter of fact, here it is. The document itself was answered. This is the answer.
Do real quick before you get to that, do you have the initial letter that this is responding to?
That's what I was just about to say.
Okay.
The original request. Letter, the request, is referred to here in the document. In statement one here, it says that the request was made on the 24th of February, 1964, re Oswald activities for the CIA. The point is, the reason why there's no formal number to it is because it wasn't through channels. It was just a personal request from one guy to another, and this is the response to the letter. And what
wasn't meant for release.
Yeah, it wasn't meant for release. It wasn't supposed to actually preserve.
I see there's yellow highlighters there. Is that just something you've done after the fact to
Yeah, that's okay. What I did after the fact. The most important of all the statements made here is in the fourth paragraph. It says, Oswald's subject was trained by this agency under cover of the Office of Naval Intelligence for Soviet assignments. And all the rest of it just confirms it all. Where he was trained, how he was trained, when he was trained, why he was trained. But it was an important document. Where did it come from? Okay.
Can I just say something about the number? No, don't turn it. It's okay. They can hear me.
Okay.
Hello, I'm here.
Gannon Groton, everybody.
The Secret Service used sort of what I would call batch numbers. That's a Secret Service generated number. So when the CIA responded to it, they were saying regarding this. Just like if I were talking to you and you sent me a bill for something and I didn't like your invoice, I would say regarding invoice, blah, blah, blah. I wouldn't make up my own number, obviously. So that's one. The other thing is the Secret Service tended to use them in batches. There are more than one document with this number, all of them having to do with Oswald and the assassination. And if you look at Vince Palomera's information on the Secret Service, the Secret Service did that with other things too. If you go into other subjects that they covered, several of the documents will have the same number.
So people
commenting on the number, it's really not as weird as they think it is.
I got you. Well, that's good. And Robert, yeah, if you can, thanks, Janet. And Robert, if you can, you're about to get to where did it come from. I think that may get some fence sitters to lean one way or the other.
Well, there was a Christmas party that was held at the HSCA just before they broke up. And I was invited down to Washington to be part of this. And while I was there and talking, I noticed that there was a door which had always remained closed, which was now open. And I asked, I said, what's the story with the room? He said, this is all stuff that's going to be destroyed. It's due to be shredded or burned, or whatever. And I said, can I look at it? And they said, sure, go ahead. And I looked in there and I saw stuff that I had created for them, some of the exhibits that were shown in the hearings. And I had asked, I said, can I have some of my own stuff back? They said, take whatever you want. So as I'm looking through it, there was this one file there, and it said Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, maybe this is his 201 file. It's his personnel file. Anyway, I started looking through it, and in the document, oh, in the documents that were in the file, someone had inserted this. It looked, I say, someone had inserted it because the numbers that are in the file are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. This, the document, the smoking gun document, was in it, but it wasn't numbered. So it was like somebody added it to the file. And they said I could take whatever I wanted. I took the file.
So, all right, so that goes a long way. You were there, provably, even the haters, as it were, would admit that you were there, right? So that's not disputed. You're saying it. I mean, I believe what you're saying. Now, I guess the only question is there a chance, you know, how did it get put in that file? You really don't know one way or the other how...
Well, Tannenbaum had it
out of the file.
Well, yeah.
Tannenbaum is legit. So
I had already seen the file. Bob Tannenbaum showed me the file 2 years earlier.
Okay.
In the office.
That's and, great.
So I knew it existed, but here it was again. Now, in the book called The Man Who Knew Too Much, he mentions it in here. And it's on the on page 675 of the original book. On record in the National Archives is a government memo, which is this memo, dated March 3rd, 1964, from the CIA's director, John McCone, to Secret Service Chief James Rowley. He goes in and he quotes it directly. When he saw it in the National Archives, it had been redacted. A lot of the stuff, the really important stuff, was already blacked out by magic marker. And but the thing is, it did exist. He saw it back in... I saw it in the early 70s. He saw it. He published it in the 90s. So I was sitting on this document for years, and I realized it was really potentially quite important.
Yeah.
And so I published it in volume in chapter one of the JFK Absolute Proof.
So you said you saw it in the early 70s. Was that, you mean before the HSCA? When did you first see it?
No, I saw it... you have to forgive me, as far as dates go, I'm not really on top of all that. I saw it when this all began, when I was brought in to the committee.
Okay.
I met Bob Tannenbaum at the very, very beginning. I was one of the few people who was there as long as he was at the beginning, and I stayed until the committee folded.
Yeah.
So one of the last people to go. The reason why I was kept around, they fired most of the people that were on the good guys who were talking about the conspiracy, you know. I was kept around because nobody else was doing what I did.
Yeah.
You know, they needed someone who actually knew the photographic evidence and the filmed evidence. And that was me. That's what I got to do.
Yeah. And did you write the HSCA? Were you involved in writing the HSCA report section on photographic evidence?
I didn't write the report. Some of the stuff I did write was included.
Okay.
But I didn't write the report itself. Cyril Wecht wrote the dissent report on the photograph, on the medical evidence. Hmm. I wrote the dissent on the photographic evidence. And one of the things I had written about was that I had mentioned that I had the opportunity to show, let me review the photographic evidence on the assassination, on the autopsy. And my conclusion from what I saw is that they were faked for two reasons. First of all, I was detecting what appeared to be fakery, and also the fact that I was familiar with the medical evidence and the medical, the doctors, what they saw, which the photographic people were not. So I realized that what we were seeing there was not the same as what they were all reporting. And I wrote about that. So
on that point, one of the, so you're talking about the autopsy photos, and there was an incident with a guy named Regis Blahut. Ultimately, he was the one that was behind it, where basically this guy who's a CIA officer, Regis Blahut, broke into a safe that was used by the HSCA that was, you know, for important evidence, including autopsy photos. They didn't take anything, but the pictures of Kennedy's head wound were taken out of their slip cases and left in disarray. And we know right. that Blahut, that's been admitted, the CIA admitted it and said, oh, he was just curious. That's the official story, is he was just curious and wanted to check it out. And then it turns out Dan Hardaway recently came forward and said that while he was working on the case, Blahut tried to get him to flip and go work for CIA while he was working for the HSCA. So
that, I didn't know. That's interesting.
Yeah.
The pronunciation of his name, I've heard as Blahut, but it's actually Blahut. And what happened was this. I had viewed the photographs and written a report, an eyes-only report, for Professor G. Robert Blakey, the head of the commission. And I wrote this, and I mentioned exactly specifically what I saw, that the hole in the back of the head appeared to be retouched and changed. As it turns out, somehow or other, through channels or otherwise, Blahut had in fact seen the report. And when he went in to the office, safe was left open, as it often was, and he went into the binder, loose leaf binder that had the pictures, and the ones he took out, which had his fingerprints on them, were the ones I had written the report about. They were the only ones. So apparently he heard somebody coming back, and he threw the photographs loose into the safe on top of the file folders and the book. And when they were discovered, they called the FBI in, they fingerprinted everything, and they found the fingerprints were on the pictures. And what he was doing was, as a result of the report that I had written, which he should not have even seen. And that's the story with that.
So do you think his fingerprints are on the pictures, which but do you think that he took the originals and substituted them for different ones, and that's what his was he really just rifling through them, or do you think he actually is switching the photos at that point?
What I think is that he had seen the report that I'd written, reported it to his superiors at the CIA, and they told him to look and see if he could see the same things I wrote about. That's what I think. Mm-hmm. And he was just examining them. And I still say that I can see the retouching. I published the pictures in Absolute Proof. And people can see what I'm talking about. I talk about what the doctors had told me. I interviewed something like 20 of the Dallas doctors. And between them and the autopsy people and all over the place, I had 79 people who had seen the president's head wounds. And every one of them, without exception, everyone had written that the exit wound for the fatal shot was in the back of the president's head.
Mm-hmm.
Even Mrs. Kennedy was talking about the back of the head. She said, from the back, you could see, you know, you were trying to hold his hair on and his skull on. You couldn't. There was nothing there. In the book, there's a whole section of the witnesses, first in Dealey Plaza, then in Parkland Hospital, then at the autopsy itself, and in between. We have 79 witnesses that saw the head wounds that said the hole was in the back of the head.
Right.
And then we had the House Assassinations Committee report, which said that what the doctors in Dallas saw is not the same as what they saw at the autopsy, which was an absolute lie. It wasn't true. They all saw the head wound as an exit in the back of the head.
Yeah. Right, but they weren't trying to do an autopsy. They were just working on him. And so, as you know, when doctors and nurses work on medical patients, if they're not doing an autopsy, they're actually blind and they don't see anything. So they were blinded because they weren't. I'm kidding. The point is, like, that's always the counterpoint is like, what do you mean? What do you mean all these doctors saw a hole in the back of his head? They weren't even looking for that. I know they saw it and they weren't looking for it. Imagine how big it was. Right? Like,
one of the most important of the witnesses that I interviewed, and these are all doctors who had never seen the autopsy photographs. They weren't allowed to see them. One of the most important people was Audrey Bell, one of the nurses in Parkland. And I said, did you see the wound and the wounds in the back? And she said, yes, they called me over and they lifted the president up and they showed me the wounds in the back and the back of the head, which is exactly the opposite of what the official story was. But she said that the exit wound was in the back of the head. Every one of the doctors and people I spoke to, I asked them, I said, where was it? They all took their right hand and put it right here on the back of their head. One after the other, including O'Neill, Francis O'Neill, one of the two officials that were with the president's body between Dallas and the autopsy. And he told me the same thing. He said, he just went like this. Quint Hill, the Secret Service agent who jumped on the back of the car, we all see in the Zapruder film, I asked him, where was the exit? Where was the large hole in the president's head? He went, right there, back there. And I said, where did the shot come from? He said, from the depository.
Right.
Now, he couldn't put two and two together for some reason.
Sure. But, let's go on to, here's another exciting chapter of Robert Grodin's resume. You worked on the film JFK, Oliver Stone's JFK, and you were a consultant in the film, but you also appear in the movie. So you're a doctor at Parkland Hospital. I don't know if I realized that part of it, but probably the coolest part is you play the guy who's showing the Zapruder film at the Clay Shaw trial. And I saw that in the movie, and I had, you know, seen The Men Who Killed Kennedy, so I was familiar with what you looked like from that. As a kid, imagine what I must have been like as a teenager, like seeing these things. People were like, what are you talking about? I'm like, oh my gosh, Robert Grodin's in the movie JFK. They're like, what? Anyway,
I play five roles in the movie.
Oh wow.
But nobody caught it. Nobody caught it. In some of the roles, I've got the beard. In some of them, I had to shave it off and beard as a doctor with it, without, once with it, once without it. It was an incredible pleasure to be working for Oliver Stone. It was terrific. I'll always be very, very proud of that. And in fact, I got to play five roles in the film itself, even though, yeah, I didn't get credited for it.
Sure.
Except for the one of the five. But one of the things that was really, really important I was able to do with that is Oliver called me in for the scene where Kevin Costner as DA Jim Garrison, he's talking about the wounds. Well, for some reason or another, it had gotten screwed up as they had the wound coming out of the chest and breaking the bone on the way out. In fact, it was on the way in, and secondary parts of the rib entered the lung and flattened it.
Connolly.
Mm-hmm.
Connolly?
Yeah, I'm going with Connolly. Right. Thanks, son. And it just screwed up the whole thing, so I got to explain the whole thing to it. And the way Jim is doing the explanation to all the wounds was changed last minute and made right. So I was very, very proud to be part of that.
Good.
Yeah.
Very good. What was it like working with all those? I mean, did you actually get to interact with any of the big stars in your time?
Yeah, I definitely did. For a movie maven like me, that was quite a kick.
Well, what about Costner? Do you work with him?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Nice guy?
Yeah, we're talking to my son, Robbie, my eldest son. And we're coming down. He was coming down for the last day of shooting in Washington, D.C. And I saw him introduce you to Kevin Costner like that. He says, Dad, you're pushing this out of proportion. I said, you don't really know Kevin Costner. So, very first day, on the set, the limo drove up and Kevin got out and said, "Hey, Robert, how you doing?" And my son Robbie said, "You really do know him." it was quite a trip.
Yeah. Well, cool. Yeah. That's great that Oliver Stone did that. Also that he brought Garrison in to play Earl Warren is another example of sort of tipping the cap to people that did important things in the case. Okay, so I want to move on to the authenticity of the Zapruder film real quick. Just come back to that. So there's been a documentary a few years ago about how the Zapruder film is faked. I have a whole episode about this.
It's a mockumentary.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
First of all, it's not true. I don't know why this half dozen people or so have started this phony rumor. The result of it is the most important single piece of evidence that we've got, the Zapruder film, is being challenged, and the other side must be laughing their rear ends off.
Right.
And we're hearing some crazy, crazy stuff. Like, we know the film is fake because it only shows one person jumping into the car. In fact, there were two. No, there weren't.
Right. Well, there is. So I'll steel man the other side of the argument for just a second. And just so you know, I'm kind of on the fence, so I'm hoping maybe you can get me off the fence here a little bit. So here's what it is. Doug Horn, who's pretty solid on medical evidence vis-a-vis ARRB and his time there, and obviously he's dedicated his life to this. It's not like he's just making it up out of nowhere. It's a theory, right? That you would say has some holes in it. So, long story short, there's basically the argument. They deliver this the film to Hawkeye Works, and then they, long story short, there were two versions of the film, one that showed a big old blowout and then one that didn't, and they had to blow the film, you know, they had to blow the images up, and the one they ended up saving was an edited one that wasn't the first one they saw the first night. They kind of lay out the people and whatever. Now, there's a counterpoint to that. This guy, Roland Zavada, who was the photographic expert, and he was like the number one photo. He's like the guy on being a photographic expert. And he breaks down in detail how none of that's true with a technical analysis. So that for me is why, the way that Horn lays it out is fairly compelling, I'll say, but the Zavada thing gave me pause to go, I don't know about that. But I think what you're maybe can speak to the, You know, obviously you are the expert on the Zapruder film in the world. So maybe you can speak to why that couldn't be possible. What's the best argument against the argument that the film has been altered?
Oh gosh, there's so many. He keeps coming up with these crazy things. Their main argument is that the film was cut. You say, where? And they say, well, you can't tell because it was done so well. Where they say it was done made no sense because it's not where any shots that were actually fired or could have been fired. Their main argument is, this is like the Zapruder camera. This is same model, same type. The action of the camera is a manual wind, which is this here, this little doohickey. You wind it up, and it creates a tension on a spring within the camera. Zapruder was filming the motorcade. The camera was either running low on the wind or stopped shooting completely. And he stops. First of all, he didn't know where in the motorcade procession the president's car was. He had no idea. When he saw the original early motorcycles coming, he figured, I'll get it now. And he starts filming, and the wind is running down on the camera. Still no president. It was like eight cars back. So he stops filming, and he's winding the camera. While he's winding the camera, the car makes the turn onto Elm Street. He wasn't filming it, period. He just simply wasn't filming it. One of the arguments that that Doug Horn and the others are saying is, it's got to be fake because it doesn't show the president making the turn onto Elm Street.
We got 30 seconds.
He didn't film it. It's that simple. There's a piece of one frame of the film, just one frame out of 486 frames, that has a piece of dirt or something on the back of the president's head. And they think that this is a piece of crayon or magic marker, so just hiding the wound in the back of his head. Well, where it shows it is not exactly where the head wound was. You can see the head wound at frame 335 and 337 very clearly. That's when president's head is in profile. But they're saying that this one frame shows what appears to be retouching. It has not been retouched at all. First of all, he wouldn't have had the time to do it, number one. Number two, there's an issue of the film is 8mm, but the actual format is 16mm wide. You shoot one side, then when it's finished, you turn it over and you shoot the other side. And then it's put together, spliced together as a single 8mm frame. When the film was sent to Chicago, it had not been slit. It was still 16mm wide. When the Hawkeye Works people were working on the film,
Hawkeye, NPIC.
NPIC, yes, National Photo Interpretation Group. They had to send out for an 8mm projector. They didn't have one. So they actually had to do that. You could not project a double 8 film because it won't fit in the projector. Period.
So it goes from Zapruder's camera and then it goes to Chicago. Now, who's it going to in Chicago?
To Life Magazine.
So they bought it that day, right away.
They bought it, well, actually the next day they bought it. They bought the rights, the still rights, the first day, and motion picture rights. They just bought the film outright forever. What?
Brugioni did not have the original, like Doug Horne thinks.
Yeah, General Brugioni did not have the original film. He thought he did. He thought he did because they told him it was the original. They had nothing to compare it to. Here's the thing. The film, if you remember correctly, the very first time I published any of the pictures were in black and white. Okay. In Chicago, Life magazine had the film duplicated onto black and white negative. If the film had already been slit, they couldn't have done that. They'd have only one side. We have copies, which I've seen of Life's office, of the double rank 8 unslit. So they could not have had the original. They could not have altered the original and all the duplicates in the same way. It just, there's so many problems with their arguments. They said, oh, we got 52 people say the film stopped. I mean, the car stopped. It did not stop. It never stopped. The Zapruder film, the Nix film, the Muchmore film, the Bronson film, all of them show that the car never stopped.
It slowed down materially, and then it sped up, but it never stopped.
Never stopped. Exactly right. It slowed. It was stopping, but it never stopped.
Yes.
They misread that. I don't know whether they're doing it on purpose or whether they're lying about it or whether they just don't know what they're talking about. I talk about these so-called film experts that they don't know an F-stop from a bus stop. And in fact, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're talking about. They're doing a great deal of damage to the whole history of the case and the film because they want to have created something on their own. And the people that know this, that say this, they don't know what they're talking about. They really don't.
Have they ever, I guess I'm talking about Doug specifically, has he responded to your points?
Oh, yeah. He says, I'm wrong, and he's right. Well, the point of the matter is that he has never held the original film. He's never seen the original film, the camera original. I've worked with it twice through the years. Yeah. And in fact, an original film is called B-wind. The way B-wind works is to view it so it's not mirror image, where the holes are on the from the projector are on the left-hand side, the picture's on the right, which is the way it's supposed to be. When you see it that way, you're looking through the emulsion side of the film. The chemical side, the chemistry side, is on the other side. A duplicate would show that as an A-wind, which is the opposite way. That in order to view it correctly, you're looking through the base instead. So you're looking through the emulsion instead of the base. And the original film, you're looking correctly. If it were an optical duplicate, it would be the opposite. So, you know, I understand that because I did this for more than a decade as my only source of income, and so I dealt with all this stuff. And all the issues of the case, I have held the original. They have not. Not a single person who says it's fake has ever even seen the original in their hands. They have not had a chance to touch it. I've worked on it. The people who did the work for MPI when they duplicated the film and for the documentary Images of an Assassination. Again, of all the things through the years that has been the biggest waste of time, energy, and money has been fighting this issue of authenticity.
Sure. So
if it were faked, who would be in a position to want to say it the worst? Me.
Sure, yeah, right.
So there's a conspiracy there. In fact, that film, which is the greatest single piece of evidence of the conspiracy. We have a real conspiracy there. Why create a phony one about the film being faked? It wasn't.
Okay.
Thank you for the opportunity for letting me talk about that.
Yeah, no, that's I talked to how I covered it initially. I have like a produced episode on this somewhere in the medical episodes. I basically laid out, you know, Doug's argument, and I laid out the Roland Zavada argument. But you have even more context to share with that. And so, like I said, you know, Doug is a friend, acquaintance, but doesn't mean I can't disagree with him, you know? So it's all good. And I hear what you're saying. Last question here. This is sort of a big general question. You know, after all the time you spent working on this, do you have a concrete theory of sort of who the culprits are? Or is it still an open question to you?
I don't know who did it. I don't know who didn't do it. Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald was seen when the shots were fired, and he was on the second floor of the depository. I have not seen a single piece of evidence against him that isn't conjecture. Did he own the gun? Even that is questionable. It was paid for through a money order that to this day has still never been cashed.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. Number two, originally there were FBI and Dallas police reports written on the number of bullet shells that were found up on the sixth floor. Both of them say there were only two. Well, two wasn't enough, so they made it three. They came back and they took the pictures all over again on the sixth floor 2 days later on Monday. And they show three shells. But originally, both reports said only two. Where did that other one come from? The rifle itself that he was supposed to have fired, Oswald was supposed to have fired, when it was tested by the FBI, they had to take off the scope and put on three metal shims. Otherwise, they couldn't even test fire it. There's all kinds of problems like this. People that knew Oswald for months kept saying that he was a big fan of President Kennedy, that he had no motive to do it. The Warren Commission, when asked about a motive, had to say that they couldn't even find a motive, that they shouldn't even deal with that issue.
Yeah. I should ask you, since you're a photographic expert, there's one more question I should ask you about, which is, do you have an opinion on the backyard photo that's supposed to show Oswald? I know there's a few photos and a few frames and a few versions of it, et cetera. But overall, do you think it's authentic and someone like told Oswald to pose like that? Or is it someone else's face? Or what do you think is going on there?
Well, there are three photographs. Originally, there were four. Marguerite Oswald, Lee's mother, apparently tore up and destroyed one of the four. But the other three are definite fakes. There are so many reasons. I haven't dealt with those issues in quite a while. The book I had before this one, which is my eighth book, I wrote a seventh book called The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald. And The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, I dealt with that. There's whole sections of it. Unfortunately, the book is now out of print. We're trying to find a way to make more. But
okay.
The thing is, outside of physical problems with the face itself and what appears to be a physical splice in the neck and different chins, Oswald under arrest had a pointed chin with a square base to it. In the photograph, it's rounded, no base. It's the shadows behind him are on the wrong direction. The one on his nose is horizontal on the side. On the neck, it's vertical. There's just a lot of problems with it. I spoke to Marina Oswald some years ago about the photographs. She said she didn't take these pictures. She said the pictures she took, she was standing by the stairs, and Lee was in the alleyway. Well, these pictures we've seen are the other way around. Sure. Pictures taken from the alleyway toward the stairs. And she said she did not take these pictures. She took some pictures, but these aren't them.
Wow.
This all kinds of the heights of the man in the photograph changes from faces from picture to picture. But when you overlay the face, so it's identical size wise, the man who's standing in the photograph is different heights. There's all kinds of problems with it.
There's a ring finger issue too. The rings on different fingers.
Yeah, there's that too. There's the fact that the bush in the background at the time she was supposed to have taken this picture, they weren't in bloom. They are in the photographs. There's all kinds of problems like that.
Right. Well, hey, thanks so much for joining us today. But before we leave, I do want to point out that you have a lot of books that you've written. Probably your most famous book is High Treason. Would you say that's your, is that the case?
High Treason is the bestseller. High Treason was number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 1 week. And very proud of that. Yeah. But best of all, the 8 books is the one you're holding in your hand there.
Yeah, this is amazing. It's just, it's full color. It's got so many original photos that it's so hard to find these online. Do check out Robert Grodin's books. High Treason and JFK Absolute Proof are the two that I have. What other ones can people pick up that are currently available?
Well, actually, The Search for Lee Harvey Oswald, we're out of. We don't have it anymore. As it turns out, the publisher was approached by the CIA and told to stop publishing it.
Amazing.
And they did. And they did. The books disappeared from bookshelves all around the country. You can't get it. I have 3 copies left, which I'm preserving. The one before that was called The Killing of a President. That was the first of the photographic trilogy. But if somebody's interested in the book, I suggest strongly JFK Absolute Proof. It's by far the most complete. And we also have a DVD, which is this one here. There you go. It's called the Assassination Films. And we have another one, too, which I don't have my hands on right now, called The Killing of a President. By the way, on for anyone who orders JFK Absolute Proof directly from us, we include a bonus. That's a ticket for, there you go. Thank you, sweetie. This is the other one.
Got it?
Yeah. We include a 1963 ticket from the Texas Theater where Oswald was arrested. And it's until we run out of them, we're throwing one in for free.
Yeah.
Book.
Just send me an email and I'll send you the info.
Well, hey, thanks again so much for joining us. Obviously, you know, like I said at the top, you are a legend, sir, and it's an honor to have you on the show. And the actions that you took changed the course of history for the better. So you are the man, Robert Grodin. Appreciate you.
Bless your heart. Thank you so much. And thanks for doing such a great job. You've got a fabulous podcast situation. I'm very proud to be part of it this time.
Thank you. Appreciate that very much. Thanks, Robert.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. We have everything you need to update your window treatments with Window Images blinds and shades. We carry vinyl, aluminum, and faux wood blinds, cellular shades, and more. Plus, get them trimmed to width in-store for free. Also, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening this week.
Save big.